Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. One of the most celebrated ships in U.S. naval history bears the name of the Show Me State. It was 70 years ago today that the USS Missouri was launched, the first step in what would be a voyage into U.S. naval lore. It was aboard the battleship that the Japanese formally surrendered in Tokyo Bay, ending World War II, perhaps the Missouri's most memorable moment. The last of the great dreadnoughts, she went on to earn more of her 11 battle stars in Korea and in the Persian Gulf. Now she is permanently berthed at Pearl Harbor as a memorial museum. I'm Don Marsh. Joining me from Pearl Harbor is Michael Carr, President and Chief Operating Officer of the USS Missouri Memorial Association. Mike, so nice to have you with us.
My pleasure.
As I said earlier, I wish we were doing the interview in person with you there at Pearl Harbor. It's a little bit different weather here than you're having there. But Mike, this is actually a double anniversary, is it not? Not only the anniversary of the launching, but also of the memorial.
Yes, it's actually 15 years ago today that we opened up to the public as a memorial and visitor attraction here in Pearl Harbor. So you're correct, it's a double anniversary.
I've not been there since the Mizzou, the Big Mo, went back to Pearl Harbor, but I know what its position, and it's very symbolic being as close to the Arizona as it is.
Yes, we're 500 yards away from the bow of the Arizona. We're bow to bow. It's a, you know, the symbolic beginning and end of the war. It's in a, you know, people who come and actually stand here on our ship and look across at the Arizona, or vice versa, at the memorial, looking up at the ship, get a real, it's an emotional connection, something that you don't really get at too many other historic sites in the country, but it works very well.
You know, I've been there, and it's almost like being in a church, particularly aboard the Arizona.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mike, can you give us some of the vital statistics about the USS Missouri? Folks might be surprised about some of those statistics. The size, for instance, is, unless you've seen it, you have no idea, I guess.
Well, the ship is 887 feet long, so three football fields. It's enormous. These were the final, you know, evolution of the battleships, the dreadnoughts. The four Iowa-class battleships were incredible marvels of technology and engineering. She was 106 feet wide at the beam, just barely wide enough to get through the Panama Canal. So they were all designed that way, with a couple of feet to spare on either side. From the bottom of her hull to the top of the highest point on the superstructure is 20 stories from top to bottom. She displaces empty, as we're sitting here right now, 45,000 tons. But when she was fully loaded with men and material and oil and water, she was 55,000 tons. But those 55,000 tons could blast through the water at 35 knots, which is pretty incredible. There are four screws on the ship, propellers. Each is weighs 10 tons and is 17 feet in diameter. The engine and engineering spaces down below are marvels to view. They're still all there, and in theory, as I say, quote unquote, this ship could still go to war again, because we're maintaining all of these spaces as best we can.
And she's been in and out of service a number of times.
Well, the ship, after serving in the World War II in Korea, was decommissioned for the first time in February of 1955 and went to set in Bremerton, Washington for almost 30 years. She was recommissioned again in May of 1986 after almost 2 years of and $450 million to turn her into a modern warship with modern weaponry, all the 20 and 40 millimeter guns that had characterized her profile in World War II were all removed. This is when the Tomahawk missiles were put in place and the radar-guided SeaWiz guns were put in place. And she went on to serve in the Gulf War, and actually the Missouri fired the first Tomahawk missiles into Baghdad beginning in January. I forget the exact date, but in January of 1991. The 16-inch guns provided fire against Iraqi positions in Kuwait. That war was over very quickly. But the ship had one last official task, which was to be the centerpiece for the 50th anniversary of the attack in Pearl Harbor in December of 1991. And I understand you were there for that.
I was indeed. It's one of my most memorable moments in a long career in journalism, but that was quite a trip. Talk to me a bit, Mike, about those 16-inch guns. I mean, these things, aside from being very large, extremely accurate with great, great range.
Each gun, and there were 9 guns in 3 turrets, which all could be fired simultaneously or independently. Each gun weighed 120 tons, they could fire a 2,500-pound shell over 22 miles. It used sophisticated math and plotting to fire these guns because they could hit something the size of my house from a range of 22 miles. If a shell went 22 miles, it was in the air for almost a minute. And in that minute, of course, the gun would fire again. But, you know, in the course of a minute, of course, the earth turns. And so you can imagine that the math used to plot the guns for firing at those distances was very sophisticated. And down below in off of Broadway are the 2 plotting rooms that were used to do all of that math. And these both rooms, there's 2 of everything, at least on this ship, because of redundancy. But these rooms are giant rooms filled with early 1940-era analog computers, each of which probably has less computing power than the silly little phone that's on my desk. But the military was always at the cutting edge of technology, and they were using computers then to do the plotting for the guns.
When I was aboard I guess they called it the war room, it looked like a bunch of young men playing Nintendo when they were messing around with the weaponry.
Well, you're talking about the Combat Engagement Center,
right,
the CEC,
exactly,
which was built for the ship during its second life, which was used to manage to fire the Tomahawk missiles and all the radar-guided guns. And yes, you know, an early version. Plus, the ship also, during the Gulf War, fired the very first drones, which, you know, everybody's heard about drones because it's a big thing in the news right now. But the very first drones were fired off of the Iowa-class battleships and used in the first Gulf War. They were rocket-propelled. They would shoot off of the back of the ship and go up to about 1,000 feet, and then all the propellers would engage. And those were also managed by the people that were in that very same room.
You know, let's back up just a bit and go back to its initial wartime experience. Really, the Missouri got into the war almost at the last minute, but it didn't miss a couple of the very big shows, did it?
No. After being launched 70 years ago today, the ship spent almost another year going through further construction on the superstructure, as well as a shakedown and training of the crew. And then in February of 1945, her first battle was the attack on Iwo Jima in February and March of 1945. Subsequent to that, the ship played a crucial role in the attack on Okinawa, which was the last great battle of the war. And that was during the Okinawa battle that the ship was attacked by kamikaze planes, which is another, you know, one of our famous stories, and actually hit by a kamikaze plane. The plane hitting the side of the ship caused a small dent, which is still there. We show it to people. No one was injured or killed, but the pilot's body was recovered. And the crew initially was just going to toss the body over the side, but the captain, who was the first captain of the ship, William Callahan, was notified, and he stopped them, and he said, no, this is a soldier doing his duty, so we're going to give him a soldier's burial. So they, someone found the remnants sew a rising sun flag, and the next day they gave him a decent burial at sea. That day was April 12th, 1945, and that story never really made much news because April 12th, 1945 was also the day that Franklin Roosevelt passed away.
Sure.
That sort of dominated the news.
For those who don't know, the kamikaze planes were those suicide planes that Japan employed in the final stages of the war, kind of a desperation attempt. And, of course, the big moment, Mike Carr, was the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay, and that, too, is commemorated with a small plaque on board the Mizu.
Yes, it's up on the surrender deck, the plaque where the table stood, where the instruments of surrender were signed by all the participants. First the Japanese signed, then Douglas MacArthur signed, then Chester Nimitz signed, and then the representatives of all the other warring powers signed. But that in itself was a story because the flagship of the fleet, Bull Halsey's flagship, he was the commander of the fleet, was actually the New Jersey. And the New Jersey felt, rightly so, I guess, that they were going to be the ship that was going to be the site of the final surrender. But the commander-in-chief, Missouri's own Harry Truman, had the final say, and he decided that, no, he wanted the ship that his daughter had christened to be the surrender instrument, and so they had to transfer Halsey's flag to the Missouri, and that's that story. You know, there's actually some animosity to this day between the World War II crew members of the New Jersey and the Missouri because of that.
Well, of course, as Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. So when you're president, you can call those shots.
You can call those shots. It was his prerogative.
The next action, and of course there was plenty of travel between between Tokyo Bay and the Korean War, but the next action was in Korea. Give me a brief synopsis of its role there.
Well, it provided a lot of covering fire for the various invasions, particularly the invasion of Incheon, which you'll recall was Douglas MacArthur's call to sort of do an end run around the Chinese and Korean, or around the Korean troops. And so he launched an invasion of Incheon, which turned the tide of that war, and the Missouri provided all the covering fire for that successful invasion.
We have interviewed someone who was connected with the Korean War via the USS Missouri. One of those who served is Don Gerber. He's from Webster Groves, Missouri. It's been a long time since he served during that Korean War. That was, after all, 60 years ago. Some of the memories have faded, but others remain fresh.
Don, it was so proud to serve aboard a battleship that when we pulled into port, wherever we were, the citizens came out. And the Navy, they'd have a band there playing the Missouri Waltz or Anchors Away or what have you, you know, to welcome us. We would line the deck of the Missouri in uniform. No matter where you went, it was with great deal of pride, Don, as you can imagine.
Well, the history associated with it, it was recent history when you sailed.
Yes. Yeah, that's where the treaty was signed, but that was before my time.
Did they have the plaque in the deck when you were aboard?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. And I believe it's still there, isn't it?
It absolutely is still there. Yes, it is. Yeah. Now let's turn to the war. What role did the Missouri play in the Korean? I guess we should be correct and call it a police action rather than a war.
Well, I call it a war, Korean War. Yeah. When we went over and started firing those 16-inch guns, cannons, as you can imagine, nine of them, things kind of took good shape. You know, when that started heading into the Korean area, the bombs, why, that was serious stuff. You know, there wasn't any other ship with that kind of size of gunshot stuff.
What about those 16-inch guns? I mean, they're remarkable. What can you tell me about witnessing their firing?
Oh, Don, when they fire a broadside, you know, off to the side, boy, the ship goes backwards, or I should say sideways, in the opposite direction when they fire because of the power to them. It's just an unbelievable sensation. You know, it gives me goosebumps to sit here and even mention that part of it to you. I do remember that part of it. But I was never there when they fired all nine at one time, but I was there when they fired six at a time and so on. But it's really a jolt, as you can imagine the size of that. So
How did the crew have to prepare for that? Obviously, it was, you say it rocked the ship, and clearly it was very, very noisy.
Very noisy. The ship was shift. I forget how many inches they said, or a foot, sideways when they fired them. How did the crew, I can't tell you that because I wasn't a part of that part of the crew. I was in the electronics end of it.
But what were the electronics in those days?
Not what you know now, Don. Not at all. The very basic stuff. Very basic. It wasn't computerized. You know, it was manually done.
That's a far cry from what it was when it went into the first Gulf War, because the computer technology then was such that almost the whole thing was run by computers.
By computers, yes. Yeah. I've heard that, too. But we were not.
What about the sense of history by other members of the crew? Was this, you spoke of it, and you were well aware of its history. Did the other sailors think the same way you did?
I would guess so. And you know, the Marine Corps is on board. You know that they were butt boys to the captain of the ship and so on and so forth. I still kid them around when I do see one that's been around. But
Don, you're talking to an ex-Marine, so you'd better be very careful.
Well, you're,
about how you go with
you
this.
You are a branch of the Navy, Don. And I let everybody know that too.
Don, what about Liberty? Do you remember leaving the ship and having a little fun ashore?
Oh yeah, but I didn't do that, Don. You know, this is off to one of the deckhands came to me before we would go ashore and asked me if I had some money, that if he would loan other sailors that he knew money, like $20 for $40, you know, when you get paid,
sure,
that payday. So I would give him the cash. And we'd loan a guy $20. He owed us $40 when he came back on shore, on the boat. Well, then I got $10 of that profit, and he got $10. I end up with so many watches and so many different things that they never reclaimed, honest to God. But I never drank in my life, Don. I never had a beer, I think, so I wasn't necessary to go ashore. So I stayed aboard almost every time, I guess. So it was a money-making scheme for the deckhand, obviously.
What else do you remember, Don? I know we're going back 60 years, and it's a long, that's a long time. But anything else jump out at you?
I think it's a very limited recall I have of it. I'm just very proud to have been on board it. When people do hear about it, if they ask about your Navy, I mentioned about the battleship, they're overwhelmed to think that they just met somebody who's on aboard the world-famous battleship, which is now in Hawaii. And I do belong to the Missouri Museum over there and donate to it and so on and so forth, is because I am so proud of having been aboard it, yes.
When you visited various ports of call and people were excited to see you, were they allowed aboard to take a tour, any of that sort of thing?
No. We were heading to Korea then, of course, so they didn't want anybody on the outside of that. But as we went through the Panama Canal, everybody came out, and it barely fit through the Panama Canal. I can tell you that's one thing I do remember. We had inches on each side of the ship to get through the canal. It was so big, and you know, we're pulled through it by, I guess you'd call them like jeeps or trains on the side of it, but that kind of stuff. But whenever we went into port, it was a scene to behold. I get goosebumps when I stop and think of what that was like to do it at the time.
That's Don Gerber of Webster Groves, who served aboard the USS Missouri during the Korean War 60 years ago. Ah, the Missouri Waltz by the Marching Mizzou Band. Very appropriate here. We're talking with Michael Carr, President and Chief Operating Officer of the USS Missouri Memorial Association. He's joining us from Pearl Harbor. Mike, I'm still not over his crack about the Marines. I have to tell you that. You've met Don Gerber.
Yes, I have. I've actually visited his funeral home, and my visits to St. Louis to rally support for the ship, and just get to know the home state a little bit. It's been a year or two since I've been there, but I've enjoyed my visits very, very much.
You know, he mentioned the reception that the Big Mo got wherever it went following the Korean War. But it was on quite a tour between World War II and Korea, wasn't it?
Yes. The ship went and visited ports all over the world on a variety of functions. I recall the most famous voyage was in 1947, 1948, when the ship carried Harry Truman back from a conference that he was in Buenos Aires back to Washington, D.C. And Harry and his wife and daughter spent a couple of weeks on board during that trip. Harry ate down in the mess regularly with the sailors during that voyage, and one side of the mess down below me, one deck below where I am right now, is actually called the Truman Line. And there's pictures of he and Bess walking through the line with their tray, and Margaret sitting and having a dinner with the troops. The ship also carried the body of the Turkish ambassador back from the East Coast to Istanbul in the mid 1950s. I forget the exact date, but she's performed all kinds of voyages, and of course the midshipman cruises, in which the young sailors, while they're at Annapolis, get an opportunity to go out on a summer cruise and learn what it's like to actually be on the ship. Those midshipman cruises went all over the Atlantic and up to Norway and visited many, many ports. And I'm sure those were the types of receptions that Mr. Gerber was recalling when the ship would go into port. It was a big deal.
You know, going back to Harry Truman, I'm old enough to remember his critics at this time used to complain that he was using the USS Missouri almost as a private yacht from time to time.
Well, I guess. I don't, you know, that's before my time, but certainly he took great, great pride in the fact that his name was associated with this ship. And in my trips to Missouri, and I've been to many places, not just the Harry's Museum in Independence, but lots of corporate offices where I've discovered models of the ship. And so I know that there's a lot of pride in the state of Missouri, as well there should be, in this ship.
We're going to be talking a little bit later in the program about the famous battleship Missouri Silver, of which there is a considerable amount, and that's a story in and of itself, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. Then a bit of a hiatus for this magnificent vessel, a good long period of time, as you have indicated, before she was brought back into service.
Well, almost 30 years. The impetus, of course, was the Ronald Reagan's effort to build up a 600-ship Navy and to spend the Soviets into oblivion, which worked. But during that time, all four of the Iowa-class battleships were brought into service and modernized, and with, you know, 20th century, if you will, weaponry. And so all of the ships are, and we're in contact with all the other ship organizations that maintain our sister ships, the Iowa's in Long Beach, the Wisconsin's in Norfolk, and the New Jersey, of course, is in Camden, New Jersey.
And as you've indicated earlier in this discussion, the first shots of that first Gulf War were fired from the decks of the battleship Missouri.
That's correct. Well, the first Tomahawk, the first 16-inch round in the Gulf War, was actually fired by our sister ship, the Wisconsin. So both the Wisconsin and the Missouri participated in the liberation of Kuwait, which is what that effort was. But you'll recall that war for both ourselves and the Wisconsin was over in a day because the Army, you know, outflanked the Iraqi forces and outran the range of our guns very quickly. And so we fired our complement of Tomahawk missiles, and then we were notified that our service was no longer required, and we left station. So that particular conflict was over very quickly.
I have to take a break now. Mike Carr will do that and continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking with Michael Carr, who is President and Chief Operating Officer of the USS Missouri Memorial Association. Back to continue our discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue to commemorate the 70th anniversary, that is, of the launching of the battleship Missouri 70 years ago, that fine vessel and historic vessel that played such an important role in our U.S. naval history. My guest from Pearl Harbor is Michael Carr, President and Chief Operating Officer of the USS Missouri Memorial Association. Mike, getting back to the first Gulf War, I think a lot of people would be surprised, even though it was short-lived, that there was even a naval component to that conflict?
Well, there was. Actually, both the Wisconsin and the Missouri fired on Iraqi army that had dug in along the shore in Kuwait to fake, if you will, an amphibious landing. So they spent several days pounding positions along the beach to make it seem as if they were providing preliminary covering fire for a waterborne invasion of the shore. But instead, as you'll recall, the Army went around the backside of Kuwait via Saudi Arabia and essentially, you know, outflanked the Iraqi Army, and that was a reason why their resistance efforts crumbled so quickly.
That reminds me somewhat of some of the feint activity before D-Day in 1944.
Right, where they tried to make the Germans think that they were landing somewhere other than where they really did.
Right. I have an email here from Washington, Missouri, Mike, in which Nancy writes, I was privileged to participate in the Rhodes Scholar Program with about 30 other people from all across the country last December on the USS Missouri. We helped with work projects, were given special tours of the ship, and were allowed to sleep on the ship on the night of December 6th and then attend the ceremony at the Visitor Center on December 7th. What an honor and privilege it was. The group responsible for taking care of the USS Missouri doing a great job. I thank them for all they do. So Nancy is thanking you, Mike, and your colleagues.
Well, that's wonderful. And actually, we welcome the Rhodes Scholars groups who come several times a year. These are dedicated people, many of them who have been here multiple times. And during their visit, they always do stay on the ship one night to get the experience. But they do very meaningful work for us in various places all around the ship. And they're always welcome.
As our time begins to wind down, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about the museum and the memorial. What is there there for people to do other than just gawk at this vessel?
Well, the mission of our association is to preserve the ship and to tell her story and share her place in history. And I think we do both of those things very, very well. We spend millions of dollars every year on preserving this ship. Several years ago, we actually shut our business down for several months and took the ship into dry dock to address hull repair issues. So the ship is in magnificent condition. I think anybody who comes and looks at her will attest to that. We get last year we had about almost 600,000 visitors that came and took a tour with us. So you have several options when you come and visit the ship of either taking a guided tour or an acoustic guide tour or an iPod tour. Typically the tours last for about an hour and they, you know, take you around on the main deck. And then after you're free to go and spend as much time as you can wandering through all the public spaces that are open. The second deck, which is right below me, which was the main living area on the ship, is completely open. From the back of the ship, which was the chief petty officer's quarters, all the way around turret number two. And then on a special tour, if you want, you can put on a hard hat and go down below into the engineering spaces and see the fire rooms and the engine rooms that are open, as well as the plotting rooms that I spoke about earlier. So there's an awful lot to see, and you can spend quite a bit of time here exploring the ship.
Well, Michael Carr, I want to thank you so much for being with us and giving us a little bit of the background of the Missouri, its history, past, and what's going on with that battleship now, berthed at Pearl Harbor right across from the USS Arizona. Mike, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Always my pleasure.
Michael Carr is President and Chief Operating Officer of the USS Missouri Memorial Association. He joins us from Pearl Harbor. Another naval officer from our area spent some time aboard the Missouri. Tim Raines is a 21-year Navy veteran and is currently Vice President of Youth Programs for the Navy League St. Louis Council. He sailed on her as a St. Louis Sea Cadet in 1990.
I went with a group of Navy Sea Cadets from the ages of 12 to 18, about 40 to 50 from Missouri, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Jeff City. We flew a DC-10 out to Long Beach, California, and we went on a summer training for about 2 weeks and got underway from the USS Missouri, sailed around from San Diego to San Clemente Island, did weapons testing, shore bombardment with gunnery and artillery, and great experience for a young man at 16. To where it influenced my life for years to come and where I went today in the Navy after 21 years on active duty. Had a mentor that was a boatswain's mate that chipped and needle gunned, and we sanded the balsam wood decks to keep them clean, pristine, and making the USS Missouri look great. And then one of the biggest things that I remember with fond memories is as a young man just going in a five and a half inch gun turret and loading rounds into the barrel and shooting them downrange. Which, thinking back as a 16-year-old young man, I don't know if I would do that in the Navy today with a 16-year-old on a warship at sea. But I look back at the friends that I went on board that ship with, and I think it influenced all our lives. And going on board the USS Missouri and knowing the history from World War II to Korea to Vietnam to the Persian Gulf, that I think that history influenced my peers and my friends later on in our lives and where we went in the Navy and the Marine Corps.
5.5-inch guns that you mentioned were kind of small potatoes on a vessel like the Missouri.
Very small compared to the 16-inch guns. And you look back and you look at the number of turrets they have, and I could be off on the number, but I think we had 16 5-inch guns, and you had 9 16-inch guns. And you look in comparable ships today, you look at an Aegis cruiser or Aegis destroyer, a cruiser will have 2 5-inch guns, and a destroyer will have 1. And we could put the same rounds down target, down range with 1 5-inch with more accuracy than the amount of 5-inch they had on there. But, of course, the great thing the Missouri had and all battleships at the time was those 16-inchers that and fire for effect and shock and awe. And seeing those explode somewhere down range is amazing.
The 16-inchers, their shells, I am told, weighed as much as a Volkswagen Bug.
Yes, they did. And I stood next to one. I have a great picture when I was 16, and there we were loading ammunition near the 16-inch turret, and just this big blue training round. And, I mean, I'm 6'4 now, and I was probably about 6 feet then. And it stood almost as high to my shoulder, so it was a big round.
Also, Tomahawk missiles very much in evidence.
Well, Tomahawk missiles, it's the whole reason why the USS Missouri was recommissioned. And, you know, working later on Aegis destroyers and cruisers where I could carry a lot of Tomahawk cruise missiles and shoot a lot of Tomahawk cruise missiles. You look back and, you know, I think the max payload for Tomahawks on a battleship at that time was 16. I can carry a lot more on a destroyer today. But that was the whole reason why the Missouri was brought back, and we saw the benefits of that during the Persian Gulf War.
The Persian Gulf War was just the latest episode in the Missouri's storied history. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, the Missouri fired the first shot of the Persian Gulf War, if I remember that correctly.
They did. It was a feint to simulate an amphibious assault that was going to be taken out on the beaches of Kuwait. But as you know, that later on, that was kind of a move to, I guess, a fake out of the Iraqi forces by showing an amphibious assault when we actually did something else and moved troops to the west.
What was your own sense of history during that time you were on? You alluded to it. You knew about it as a youngster. But being actually on the ship with the teak decks and the medallion where the Japanese surrendered and the scratch on the side where the kamikaze plane scraped the ship back in 1944-45.
Correct. Aft end, starboard side by the helicopters, the flight deck. Fond memories. It was almost like a smell of the ship, a smell of history. When you're on board, you could just smell and feel the energy of what that ship had accomplished through its lifetime.
You talked about your own sense of history during the period you were a Sea Scout on board. And with your peers, do you feel that the 16 to 18-year-olds you were with had the same sense of history of the ship that you did?
With the Navy Sea Cadets and my good friends, Don and Kevin and Rebecca, and, you know, going on board that ship, knowing the history, that history of what the Missouri did and what we accomplished on the Missouri, working with other sailors and officers and influence where we went and what we achieved in life today.
Of course, you're from Missouri. It is the battleship Missouri. That had to stand for something in your mind.
Absolutely, and it seems that the USS Missouri followed my career in the Navy everywhere I went. Going to Long Beach, and that's where I was on the Missouri. Then I got stationed on aircraft carrier, the USS Carl Vinson out of Seattle, Washington, Bremerton. And that's where the Missouri was mothballed. And I had an opportunity where I worked shore patrol when I was an E-5, and I had an opportunity to work the mothballed piers. And the brows were always open, so I did. I snuck on board the Missouri and went on board. And you were talking earlier about the memorial to the Declaration of Surrender of World War II in the Tokyo Bay. Well, they put a big coin in the deck and a big ball covering the coin to protect it from weather. Well, when it was mothballed, that coin was just sitting in the deck, sitting in water, corroding, and you could see the corrosion on it. And I picked that coin up out of the deck, and it was in my hands, and I'm looking at it, and I was worried that somebody would take this coin. And you know how big that coin is, and the history of that spot and that particular coin that was made for the Declaration of Surrender. I remember I left that coin there. I kind of drained the water off, cleaned it up a little bit, and I left it there on the deck. And luckily, I was assigned to the USS Hopper in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and the USS Chung Hoon as the operations officer, as a surface warfare officer. And I could say that coin's still there. It didn't go anywhere, but I was worried for about 10 years.
When I went on board the Missouri for my trip in 1991 in Long Beach, there must have been 75 Japanese tourists who were on board at that very spot that you're talking about. And I found that most ironic, just as when you go to Pearl Harbor today and go aboard the Arizona Memorial, there are as many Japanese there as there are Americans.
Absolutely. And living in Hawaii for almost 5 years and being stationed on warships out of there, I would say yes, the Japanese do take a great appreciation and render honors at the Arizona Memorial and the USS Missouri, and one of our greatest allies in the Pacific Rim is the Japanese, and I've worked with many Japanese Aegis destroyers, cruisers, supply ships, and submarines. I have fond memories. It's amazing that we're such vicious enemies, and then later on how we become some great friends and allies. I could consider many Japanese naval officers great friends, and, you know, I'd have their side and be at their back.
That opens up a whole new discussion, if we wanted to take it, about the value of war and, you know, the fact that it's fleeting in a sense, that oftentimes the enemies become best friends, to wit the Germans, the Vietnamese now, are very much partners with us. Final question for you, Tim. You were present at the decommissioning in 1992. Given all that you've said and all the memories you had of the Missouri and of your own Navy life, recall for me what you were thinking at the decommissioning.
Well, that's a great question, Don. That at that time, I remember my friends were all sad that it was the last battleship that was being decommissioned. And, you know, I am so fond of battleships. If I could have a choice of being assigned to a battleship today or an Aegis cruiser or destroyer or a carrier, I would take a battleship in a heartbeat. I wish we still had battleships. It's just, you know, the projection of power, it's a big symbol. So that was a sad day for me because it was the last battleship that was in the fleet at the time, and it was being sent to the mothball fleet up in Bremerton. And it was also kind of a beginning for me because I was getting ready to graduate high school, and I had already signed into the land entry program. I was entering the Navy, and, you know, that was 2 months later, I was off to boot camp. And so it's also a beginning point for me, knowing that I was going to graduate high school. And from that point, I served 21 years of active duty in the Navy and retired here 2013 in March.
That's Tim Raines, Vice President of Youth Programs for the Navy League of St. Louis Council. We continue our commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the launching of the USS Missouri in just a moment with former Missouri First Lady Jean Carnahan. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. We continue our recognition of the 70th anniversary of the launching of the battleship Missouri. One of the lesser-known stories about the USS Missouri concerns its famous silver service. The beautiful service of almost 300 pieces was a gift to the ship from the people of the state of Missouri. Most of it remains here in the Show Me State. Former First Lady and former Senator Jean Carnahan was custodian of the service during her time in the governor's mansion. She's always recognized its historical significance and has written about it in her book, If Walls Could Talk. She made good use of that silver when she was in the mansion.
Since living in the mansion and the Missouri governor's mansion, we had an opportunity to serve a number of people from the Missouri Silver. In fact, we served Walter Cronkite and his family, also family members of the Churchill family and the Disney family. So it was all they always enjoyed it.
Well, what is the background of Missouri Silver? I mean, it's been assembled over a great many years.
Yes, over 100 years. Actually, it started in 1903 when a punch bowl was given to the new battleship that was had been commissioned that year. And it was made up of a huge punch bowl that held 112 pints and had 22 cups to it. Very attractive, made up with a grape design and the name Missouri on it. It's lovely. In fact, you can see it on display at the Missouri Mansion today.
I was going to ask you, where is all of this silver? Because it's moved around a little bit.
Definitely. Yeah. It's traveled quite a bit. It's traveled hundreds of thousands of miles around the world. But it's on display today in the Missouri Governor's Mansion. You could see it there. But there's more than just the punch bowl. Over the years, there were other pieces added when the Mighty Mo was commissioned. And back in 1944, they appropriated $10,000 for additional pieces. And so in 1948, Harry Truman and the governor, Governor Donnelly at the time, went aboard the ship and made the presentation of these 281 pieces. So that gave the captain the opportunity to have 18 place settings of this lovely silver, all handmade. And each one had 14 pieces of flatware that went with it, as well as such things as a finger bowl and a salt cell and salt cell spoons. So it was quite a collection, something you'd probably not see anywhere but in the dining room of Downton Abbey today.
Where did all this silver come from and why? I mean, the silver on a battleship seems to me to be kind of an unusual combination.
Well, there's a naval tradition that each state with a ship bearing the name of the state provides a place settings of silver for the captain's quarters. And so we did this in 1903. And it stayed aboard the ship, went around the world, and then was put in storage and later was brought out and used by the next Missouri. And, of course, that was a very historic ship, you recall. It was at the Battle of Okinawa and the Battle of Iwo Jima, and it was the place on which the armistice was signed after World War II. So the Missouri Silver has seen a lot of service.
I was under the impression that oftentimes when the ship would make various ports of call, that the host country would present some silver to it. Is that
I'm mistaken? Not aware of that. This was something that was done strictly by the state of Missouri.
Well, how expensive a gift is that?
Well, the estimate today is that it's probably worth about $250,000.
You mentioned that it is well traveled. How long did it take over this 100-plus years of the Missouri's history, or the history of battleships Missouri, if you will, for all of this to accumulate?
Well, it started in 1903 with just the punch bowl and the ladle and the tray. And then after that, these other pieces were added, which included the goblets and, like I said, the finger bowls and very interesting side pieces that went along with that. And then candelabras that are quite lovely. And those two are on display at the Missouri Governor's Mansion now. And I recall when we used to use it, there was sort of a routine to using it. We counted each piece as it was put on the table. We made a complete accounting for it, and then each time we put it back, we counted the pieces. And then at the end of each year, we counted the pieces again. So there was the continual accounting of the Missouri silver. And as I understand it, only two pieces are missing. And those were from our two punch cups that were lost very early in the century when after it left the first battleship.
Who actually owns the silver?
Well, there's been some confusion about that and some disagreement about it. Back in the 1980s, it was taken out of storage. And it had been taken out of storage after the Korean War and then sent to the Truman Museum. And then the Bonds had requested that it come to the mansion. And so it was at the mansion in the 80s. And we had a military buildup back then. And the Navy Department requested the silver be returned to the Missouri battleship. Well, the Governor Ashcroft and his wife were not interested in doing that. They wanted to keep the silver there at the mansion. And so there was some dispute about the ownership. And the Navy sent a delegation to the mansion. And they showed a letter that they had received back in 1922 from Governor Hyde. And he told the state that they could have the silver on loan, but that it would be subject to recall at any time, and that the packing and the shipping were also the responsibility of the state. So with that, they had to relinquish the silver, but it later came back, and that's where it resides today. If you want to see a full complement of the silver, you can see it at the Truman Museum. They have one place setting. And I have been told that there is a place setting aboard the USS Missouri in Hawaii. But I don't know that for a fact.
When you were First Lady, and I'm sure you presided over many grand dinners, Downton Abbey style, as long as you brought that up, when did you determine how or when the silver would be used? I mean, under what specific kind of occasion?
Well, it was something that they left to my discretion, and I would use it when we'd have people that I thought would appreciate using it. And then we would use it also for our family for Christmas and Thanksgiving. It was always a wonderful thing to do. People particularly enjoyed the finger bowl, because that's not something we see very often today. And they'd like to identify the different pieces that they wouldn't see normally in use on our tables today. A salt cell, for instance, is always interesting to use because you use a little spoon and a little silver bowl, and those were always fun.
I would think that at any of these dinner parties, and I'm sure this didn't occur often, there was nothing to talk about. You could always talk about
exactly.
The silver.
That's exactly right. There was always history to talk about in the governor's mansion. You could always point to a picture on the wall, and there was a story to tell about it.
And that is fun, isn't it, talking about the history of something like that has been around for so long and so well-traveled. Of course, the next stop will have to be a submarine.
Well, that's right, because the current Missouri the vessel is a submarine, but I kind of doubt that they would want all that silver because they have a shortage of space on a submarine, and these are quite large pieces.
Getting back to the conversations at the dinner table, can you recall anybody raising any issues or questions about it that might stand out in your memory?
No, I don't. People just seem to be appreciative of the opportunity to eat off of it and wondered about others who might have eaten off of it. And I kind of think maybe Harry Truman might have, because surely they would have served from it at the time they put it on board the Missouri.
Well, as I recall the story about Harry Truman and the Missouri, he used to use that at times as his private yacht.
Well, he had a private yacht, you know. Yeah. There, he kept there in Washington, and I grew up in Washington, D.C., so every day I went, and I lived in the area where the boat was docked, so every day I saw Harry Truman's yacht sitting there, except those days, of course, when he was out on it.
We all remember the stories of Harry Truman's famous walks at Washington, D.C. when he was president. But he did travel on the Missouri a number of times, as I understand
yes,
it.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Anything else about the history of this silver that you'd like to relate?
Well, I think we've covered most of it. I just think it's wonderful that the state has this that it's on display and that people can see it and that it has such a history, a rich history that is connected not only with the state but with the nation and the world.
It's up to the discretion of the sitting governor, I suppose, as to how specifically it will be displayed.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
All right. Do you miss it?
Oh, yes, I do. I always enjoyed looking at it. Usually we kept a big floral display in the punch bowl. And that was always quite lovely. We have some pictures of that. And it was very nice to use at Christmas time, especially when we were decorating. But it's a beautiful addition to the mansion, and it's certainly one of Missouri's treasures.
Former Missouri First Lady Jean Carnahan talking about the USS Missouri Silver. By the way, she mentioned that place setting at the Truman Library in Independence. You can see a picture of that on our website at sdlpublicradio.org. Our thanks to Jean Carnahan, Tim Raines, Don Gerber, and Michael Carr for being with us on this program commemorating the 70th anniversary of the launching of the Battleship Missouri. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky about Governor Pat Quinn's State of the State address. You can hear the speech tonight at 7 on St. Louis Public Radio. We'll also talk with the University of Missouri History Professor Stephen Watts about his new biography of Missourian Dale Carnegie, author of the well-known 1930s book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Archive versions of this program available for download or podcast at sdlpublicradio.org. This is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.